Christmas Eve had been, for all the Mariners except Mr. Mariner, a most exhausting day. The head of the house usually got off lightly at the festive season. Lightly, that is, as far as personal effort went. Financially, no. Mr. Mariner knew that financially, quite a heavy drain was being made on his resources. And later in the evening, when he got out his checkbook to give his customary presents to his family, his relations, and the staff, the drain would be heavier. But he could afford it. He could afford it better this Christmas than at any other Christmas in the history of his steadily increasing fortune. And he didn't have to think, he didn't have to choose. He only had to consult a list and add one or two names and cross off one or two. There was quite a big item to cross off, quite a big item, though it didn't figure on the list or on the counterfoil of his checkbook. If he saw fit, he would add the sum so saved to his children's checks. Jeremy and Anne would then think him even more generous than he was, and if his wife made any comment, which she wouldn't, being a tactful woman, he would laugh and call it a capital distribution. Capital in every sense, my dear. But this could wait till after dinner. So of the quartet who sat down to the meal, he was the only one who hadn't spent a laborious day. His wife and Anne had both worked hard, decorating the house and making arrangements for the party on Boxing Day. They hadn't spent the time in getting presents. They hadn't had to. Anne, who was 2 years older than Jeremy, inherited her mother's gift for present-giving and had made her selections weeks ago. She had a sixth sense for knowing what people wanted. But Jeremy had left it all to the last moment. His method was the reverse of Anne's, and much less successful. He thought of the present first and the recipient afterwards. Who would this little box do for? Who would this other little box do for? Who should be the fortunate possessor of this third little box? In present-giving, his mind followed a one-way track, and this year it was little boxes. They were expensive and undiscriminating presents, and he was secretly ashamed of them. Now it was too late to do anything more, but when he thought of the three or four friends who would remain unboxed, his conscience smote him, silent and self-reproachful. He was the first to hear the singing outside the window. "Listen, there's some carol singers." His voice, which was breaking, plunged and croaked. The others all stopped talking, and smiles spread over their faces. "Quite good, aren't they?"
"The first we've had this year," said Mrs. Mariner.
"Well, not the first, my dear. They started coming days ago, but I sent them away and said that waits must wait till Christmas Eve."
"How many of them are there?"
"Two, I think," said Jeremy. "A man and a woman."
Jeremy got up and drew the curtain. Pierced only by a single distant street lamp, the darkness in the garden pressed against the window pane.
"I can't quite see," he said, coming back. "But I think it's a man and a boy."
"A man and a boy," said Mr. Mariner. "That's rather unusual.
Perhaps they're choristers, Daddy. They do sing awfully well."
At that moment, the front doorbell rang. They listened for the sound of footsteps crossing the stone flags of the hall, but there was none.
"Mrs. Parfitt doesn't come till washing up time," said Mrs. Mariner. "Who'll go and give them something?"
"I will," Anne said, jumping up. "What shall I give them, Daddy?" "Oh, give them a bob," said Mr. Mariner, producing the coin from his pocket. However complicated the sum required, he always had it.
Anne set off with the light step and glowing face of an eager benefactor. She came back after a minute or two at a much slower pace, and looking puzzled and rather frightened. She didn't sit down, but stood over her place, with her hands on the chair back.
"He said it wasn't enough," she said.
"Wasn't enough?" her father repeated. "Did he really say that?"
Anne nodded.
"Well, I like his cheek."
Even to his family, Mr. Mariner's moods were unforeseeable. By some chance, the man's impudence had touched a sympathetic chord in him.
"Go back and say that if they sing another, they shall have another bob."
But Anne didn't move.
"If you don't mind, Daddy, I'd rather not."
They all three raised questioning faces to hers.
"You'd rather not? Why?"
"I didn't like his manner."
"Whose? The man's?"
Yes, the boy. You are right, Jeremy, it is a boy, quite a small boy. Didn't say anything.
Then what was wrong with the man's manner? Mr. Mariner, still genial, asked.
Oh, I don't know. Anne began to breathe quickly, and her fingers tightened on the chair back. And it wasn't only his manner. Henry, I shouldn't, began Mrs. Mariner warningly, when suddenly Jeremy jumped up. He saw the chance to redeem himself in his own eyes from his ineffectiveness over the Christmas shopping, from the general ineffectiveness that he was conscious of whenever he compared himself with Anne.
"Here's the shilling," Anne said, holding it out. "He wouldn't take it."
"This will make it two," their father said, suiting the action to the word. "But only if they sing again, mind you."
While Jeremy was away, they all fell silent. Anne still trying to compose her features, Mr. Mariner tapping on the table, his wife studying her rings. At last she said, "They're all so class-conscious nowadays."
"It wasn't that," said Anne.
"What was it?"
Before she had time to answer, if she would have answered, the door opened and Jeremy came in, flushed and excited, but also triumphant, with the triumph he had won over himself. He didn't go to his place, but stood away from the table looking at his father.
"He wouldn't take it," he said. "He said it wasn't enough. He said you would know why."
"I should know why?" Mr. Mariner's frown was an effort to remember something.
"What sort of a man is he, Jeremy?" "Tall and thin, with a pulled-in face."
"And the boy?"
"He looked about 7. He was crying."
"Is there anyone you know, Henry?" asked his wife.
"I was trying to think. Yes, no, well, yes, I might have known him." Mr. Mariner's agitation was now visible to them all, and even more felt than seen.
"What did you say, Jeremy?"
Jeremy's breast swelled.
"I told him to go away."
"And has he gone?"
As though in answer, the bell pealed again. "I'll go this time," said Mrs. Mariner. "Perhaps I can do something for the child." And she was gone, before her husband's outstretched arm could stop her.
Again the trio sat in silence, the children less concerned with themselves than with the gleam that kept coming and going in their father's eyes like a dipping headlight.
Mrs. Mariner came back much more self-possessed than either of her children had. "I don't think he means any harm," she said. "He's a little cracked, that's all. We'd better humour him. He said he wanted to see you, Henry, but I told him you were out. He said that what we offered wasn't enough, and that he wanted what you gave him last year, whatever that means. So I suggest we give him something that isn't money. Perhaps you could spare him one of your boxes, Jeremy. A Christmas box is quite a good idea."
"He won't take it," said Anne,
before Jeremy could speak.
"Why not?"
"Because he can't," said Anne.
"Can't? What do you mean?"
Anne shook her head. Her mother didn't press.
"Well, you are a funny girl," she said. "Anyhow, we can but try. Oh, and he said they'd sing us one more carol."
They set themselves to listen, and in a moment the strains of "God Rest You Merry Gentlemen" began. Jeremy got up from the table.
"I don't think they're singing the words right," he said.
He went to the window and opened it, letting in a puff of icy air.
"Oh, do shut it.
Just a moment. I want to make sure." They all listened, and this is what they heard.
"God blast the master of this house, likewise the mistress too, and all the little children that round the table go."
Jeremy shut the window.
"Did you hear?" he croaked.
"I thought I did," said Mrs. Mariner, "but it might have been bless. The words sound so much alike. Henry, dear, don't look so serious."
The doorbell rang for the third time. Before the jangling died down, Mr. Mariner rose shakily.
"No, no, Henry," said his wife. "Don't go. It'll only encourage them. Besides, I said you were out."
He looked at her doubtfully, and the bell rang again, louder than before.
"They'll soon get tired of it," she said, "if no one comes. Henry, I beg you not to go." And when he still stared at her with groping eyes, she added, "You can't remember how much you gave him last year." Her husband made an impatient gesture with his hand. "But if you go, take one of Jeremy's boxes."
"It isn't a box they want," he said. "It's a bullet."
He went to the sideboard and brought out a pistol. It was an old-fashioned saloon pistol, a relic from the days when Henry's father, in common with others of his generation, had practiced pistol shooting, and it had lain at the back of a drawer in the sideboard longer than any of them could remember. "No, Henry, no, you mustn't get excited. And think of the child." She was on her feet now. They all were.
"Stay where you are," he snarled.
"Anne, Jeremy, tell him not to. Try to stop him." But his children could not, in a moment, shake off the obedience of a lifetime, and helplessly they watched him go. "But it isn't any good. It isn't any good," Anne kept repeating. "What isn't any good, darling?" "The pistol. You see, I've seen through him." "How do you mean, seen through him? Do you mean he's an impostor?" "No, no, I've really seen through him." Anne's voice sank to a whisper. "I saw the street lamp shining through a hole in his head. Darling, darling, yes, and the boy, too." "Will you be quiet, Anne?" cried Jeremy from behind the window curtain. "Will you be quiet? They're saying something. Now Daddy's pointing the gun at him. He's got him covered. His finger's on the trigger. He's going to shoot." "No, he isn't. The man's coming nearer. He's come right up to Daddy. Now he's showing him something, something on his forehead. Oh, if I had a torch. And Daddy's dropped it. He's dropped the gun." As he spoke, they heard the clatter. It was like the sound that gives confirmation to a wireless commentator's words. Jeremy's voice broke out again. "He's going off with them. He's going off with them. They're leading him away." Before she or any of them could reach the door, Mrs. Mariner had fainted. The police didn't take long to come. On the grass near the garden gate, they found the body. There were signs of a struggle. A sliver, like a skin mark on the gravel. Heel marks dug deep into the turf. Later it was learnt that Mr. Mariner had died of a coronary thrombosis. Of his assailants, not a trace was found. But the motive couldn't have been robbery. For all the money he had in his pockets, and all the notes out of his wallet, a large sum, were scattered around him, as if he had made a last attempt to buy his captors off, but couldn't give them enough.
The Waits by L.P. Hartley was read by Robert Lang and produced by Peter Cavanagh.